Has Donald Trump peaked? According to JU, new poll numbers say not yet anyway, at least not yet here in Florida. We'll tell you about it just ahead. Good Monday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Melissa Ross. Hope you had a great weekend. Keep listening because just ahead we have new poll numbers on the 2016 field as we take your calls at 549-2937. Then later, First Coast Success profiles a local sports standout, Nancy Hogshead McCarr. Plus, Culpepper on the Jaguars' loss. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, Donald Trump remains the front runner among Republican presidential candidates here in Florida. Right behind him, former Florida Governor Jeb Bush. Former Hewlett-Packard CEO Carly Fiorina is surging. Neurosurgeon Ben Carson has lost a little ground, and U.S. Senator Marco Rubio is on the rise. All of this, according to a Jacksonville University Public Policy Institute poll of registered Republican likely voters. Rick Mullaney directs JU's Public Policy Institute, and he joins us now in studio with the poll results and analysis. Rick, good to see you. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Great to be here.
And here's our question to callers. What are your thoughts about the 2016 presidential field and these latest poll numbers? 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show. So this is the first time JU has put a statewide poll in the field looking at a presidential race. Pretty exciting.
It's very, very exciting. And it's right in with the mission of the Public Policy Institute at Jacksonville University to be involved in matters of importance in public policy. We're very appreciative to our board for the Institute for making this possible, and we look forward to doing more of this in the future.
So the results came out the other day showing that in Florida, Donald Trump is still the front runner among likely Republican voters, former Florida Governor Jeb Bush right behind him, correct?
That's right. Jeb Bush is in second. I think for many people, Governor Bush in the second debate really needed to come through to shore up support among donors in particular. This poll reflects that he may have stopped the bleeding. And by that, I mean he's a little bit. Certainly not the strong performances in the second debate as Carly Fiorina or Marco Rubio, but a very strong performance, particularly in the third hour. So he remains in second place in this poll.
What are your thoughts about a recent piece that ran on the website Politico it was in the Washington Post over the weekend. The reporter spoke to several donors in Jeb Bush world saying that they're increasingly becoming concerned about Jeb Bush's poll numbers and his performance on the campaign trail. Some of them are defecting to the Rubio campaign, saying that if Jeb Bush doesn't step up his game pretty soon, they're going to swing their muscle and their financial support either to Marco Rubio or somebody else.
Well, to some extent, it's not surprising. Let's face it, Donald Trump has sort of transformed this campaign into something nobody expected. And clearly, for all the candidates, it's particularly true for Jeb Bush. In the first debate, I think he took a do-no-harm type of approach, and he found that that really did not work very well. And in fact, what you saw is dwindling poll numbers for him post the first debate. Going into the second debate on September 16th, it was high stakes for Governor Bush. And I think in the last hour, he had a very strong performance. He began to come on, and I think he did enough to shore up some confidence among many of his donors. He has the organization. He has the money. He has the experience, so he is still very formidable. People shouldn't be fooled by those dwindling numbers this far out with the first primary 4 months away and the Florida primary 5.5 months away. No surprise, but I think Governor Bush has learned he's going to have to show some passion, he's going to have to show some energy, and he's going to have to go out and win this.
And if you're just tuning in, what are your thoughts about Donald Trump leading Republican voters in Florida, not the favorite sons of Florida, Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio? We'll go to your calls in a moment at 549-2937. So Rick Mullaney of JU's Public Policy Institute, the top five are Trump, Bush, Carly Fiorina, the former Hewlett-Packard CEO, neurosurgeon Ben Carson, and of course, Senator Marco Rubio. Those are the top five, according to Florida likely Republican voters. Let's talk about these others. Carly Fiorina doing very well right now.
Absolutely. So one of the things that this poll reflects is some good news for Carly Fiorina and for Marco Rubio. if you look at the pre-debate polls, the consensus of polls from Real Clear Politics, it shows that both are up substantially. In Florida, Carly is up nearly 10 points, Marco's up 8 points, and really it's margin of error as far as how close they are, this third, fourth, and fifth ranking. So some very good news for them. Another part of the poll that shows good news for them is very high favorability ratings for each of them, which suggests that they have some upside. That is a little bit different from Donald Trump. The poll reflects maybe some storm clouds in his future, maybe a bit of a limit on how far he can go, given his high unfavorabilities and also given the fact that more voters say they would not vote for him than anyone else. But good news in this poll for Carly Fiorina and for Marco Rubio.
You think maybe Donald Trump has peaked? A new NBC Wall Street Journal poll that came out Sunday shows him virtually tied with neurosurgeon Ben Carson among Republican primary voters. That's a national poll.
It is a national poll, and it was 21% to 20%. In Florida, we had it at 24.4%. Previous polls had it at 30%. The trend appears to be, and these things change so much, you don't want to be too emphatic, but the trend appears to be that he sort of hit a ceiling, that he may have a ceiling, and the trend is downward. Now, where those votes go is very interesting. Some of it appears to be going to Carly Fiorina, some of it going to Ben Carson. Those three outsiders, according to our poll, are very favored in general because of this sort of this rebellion, I guess you would say, against elected officials and politicians.
There's such an angry mood among the Republican electorate, this feeling that the establishment, whether it's the leadership in Washington or the establishment candidates, isn't reflecting their priorities. Do you think that's reflected in these numbers?
I think it is. When you take a – well, it's in the numbers and also in some of the questions we asked. We asked, for example, do you believe that an elected official should have – would it be better to have private business experience or government experience? A surprising 40% to maybe 20% said business over government, with the rest thing makes no difference. Even bigger, we asked the question of, do you think it's important to be elected office before serving? Big majority, 68% to 28% said no, that is not the case. And so there clearly, at least among Republican primary voters, is a significant frustration with Washington and elected officials.
We're seeing that on the Democratic side as well. Hillary Clinton is still the front runner for the presidential nomination among Democrats. However, Bernie Sanders is creeping up upon her. There's frustration on the left we're seeing as well.
There's no doubt about that. You're seeing big crowds for Bernie Sanders. You're seeing his poll numbers very strong in Iowa, very strong in New Hampshire. That does reflect part of that frustration also. Now, Hillary, of course, has the money, the organization, the staying power, and the strength. The wild card in the Democratic side will be if Joe Biden enters the race. The other wild card is, and this is a little bit beyond Hillary's control, what really are on those emails and what plays out in the future with the FBI in control of the server. That remains to be seen.
Absolutely. And of course, Florida, always so important on the GOP side, 99 GOP delegates, crucial to gaining the party's nomination. Our primary is March 15th, a winner-take-all primary. Whoever gains the GOP nomination, Florida is such a prize.
There is just no doubt about it. For the listeners, it's really important to note that the February primaries, there's four of them, starting off with Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Nevada. All of those are proportional, meaning that you will get a delegate according to your percentage of the vote, and all of them have a relatively small number of delegates. From March 1st to March 14th, there's a whole bunch of primaries. All of them are proportional. Yeah. Florida's is winner take all on March 15th. It's a huge number of delegates at 99. It is a big prize in the primary.
And we have the most electoral votes of any state, don't we?
No, the most most electoral is California and New York.
We're right behind them, though.
We're right behind, California and Texas. We're right behind them. We're third. Texas, by the way, in the primary is a proportional state. And so they have 155 delegates at stake, but they'll be divided up proportionally. So Florida remains the big prize in the primary.
In 2012, as you pointed out with the release of this poll, Florida was the only state decided by less than 1%. In 2012, Barack Obama beat Mitt Romney 50.0% to 49.1%. That is a razor-thin margin.
Well, Melissa, if you think that's razor-thin, let's look back to 2000.
Yeah, exactly.
In 2000, I had the honor of serving on both the canvassing board and being legal counsel.
The honor? Would you call it maybe the headache?
actually, it was both. It was an honor. However, I remember driving into the office that day, And my secretary was calling me up and said, you need to go to City Hall, and or actually over to where, City Hall from where we were at that time. And there was a 500-vote difference. And people may remember in 2000 that it all came down to that. Mm-hmm. What has happened since is that it is generally recognized that 40 states are not in play. About 10 are. And of the 10 that are, Florida is the biggest prize. It's 29 electoral votes. It's a purple state. It can go Democrat. It can go Republican. If you want to win the White House, you need to win Florida. And right after, closely behind that is Ohio. But Florida is a very big prize, and it can go either way depending on how the candidates are doing.
And so let us know right now who you think will win Florida. Let us know your thoughts on the JU presidential poll as we speak with the director of JU's Public Policy Institute, Rick Mullaney. He's also the host of our quarterly show, Policy Matters, on this radio station, 549-2937. Mark is in St. Augustine. Hi, Mark. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hey, thank you. I just kind of had a question. I mean, you can look at the past history from the past several congressional elections and how, at least on the Republican side, it seemed that America was electing people that they really hoped would change Washington. You know, I know it sounds kind of cliche, but that's what they were hoping. And then they continued to get disappointed. I mean, look at Boehner having to step down now. And it seems to me that, you know, if a guy wants to buy a blue suit, you sell him a blue suit. Donald Trump, Ben Carson, Carly Fiorina, they're selling us the stuff that many people on the right are wanting to buy right now. And I just wonder why some of the other candidates, you know, let's say Rubio or Bush, it almost seems like those folks in the RNC are scratching their heads saying, we can't figure out why these guys aren't getting any traction. Well, they're not selling us what it is that we want. And I just wonder, when are they going to wake up to that and say, all right, if we want our constituency to vote for us in this way, then we have to give them and deliver to them what it is that they're wanting.
Thank you, Mark. Mark in St. Augustine.
It's a very good point, and this is being much discussed around the country, particularly with the resignation of the speaker. And part of it points to, part of what the setting needs to include a realistic view of how divided government works. One of the challenges that you have in Washington, if you're a Republican, from a Republican perspective, those who want to advance their agenda, is that you do not have 60 votes in the Senate. You don't have that majority. Therefore, you can't get past the filibuster. That's been the problem with the Iran deals from a Republican perspective, as well as other issues. And you don't have the White House. And so it's one thing in the off-year elections to send a majority in the House, which we have, but not a supermajority in the Senate, in terms of how Republicans view it. It is a little bit unrealistic to think that with not controlling the White House and not having 60 in the Senate that you can get whatever you want. Therefore, it requires – there is this built-in tension in Washington. It is easier for an outsider who's not a part of it to really play this hard in terms of they're not getting anything done. But if you're – you know, it's my old – friend of mine used to say it's a lot easier to tell someone how to wrestle the bear than to wrestle it yourself. Once you start wrestling that bear in Washington, it is very, very difficult. But the caller makes a very good point. There is a frustration. You saw 2 years ago, or actually just last year when you saw the midterm elections, majorities of Republicans going to House and Senate, a sense that maybe something else was coming. And there's been some frustration among some that that hasn't happened.
Sure. In particular, it seems the frustration stems from the fact that the Affordable Care Act, it continues to roll out. The Iran deal went through. Those two things in particular. Would you agree?
I do agree with that. And you have to remember the Affordable Care Act was passed during the first 2 years of the Obama administration when he did have more than 60, or about 60 in the Senate. He had super majorities. He was able to get that through, not a single Republican vote. And on the Iran deal, because it was not framed as a treaty, you needed two-thirds here. An event to override a veto, and it did not come to the vote because of the filibuster rule in the Senate. And so that frustration on both of those issues has been big among some Republicans.
Let's go now to Bill in Mandarin. Hi, Bill. Thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Good morning. Good morning. I think the thing, and it said playing on Trump, a couple of things. One, before the first Republican debate, everybody saying, ha, 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 a joke, he'll be toast, you know, in a few weeks. After that debate, everybody's saying, oh, my gosh, this guy's a comer. And then after his last debate, you guys seem to be telling us why he should not be elected. As far as Carla goes, they're grooming her for vice president. We need a token on the ticket, and she fits all the scripted needs. I think Mr. Trump, if he shied down a little bit on his New Yorker-type response image, he would probably find himself having lower unpopular side of the Democrat thing. Thank you.
Why is Carly Fiorina, in your view, a token?
Well, we need a girl.
Well, she's a woman, not a girl. She's a woman, not a girl.
My thrust. My greatest apology, of course.
Okay.
But she really brings nothing to the game. I've not seen an original thought coming from her. It's a usual response. I'm going to build the military. I'm going to, you know, the safe type of responses. But nothing that is exciting, I don't think.
Bill, thanks for the call. Rick Mullaney.
Well, a couple things. I think the caller makes a good point that before the first debate, he says many people considered it a joke. I do think many people were dismissive of his chances. I hate to admit this publicly. I did not, when he first came out, I did not rate the chances very high, and he certainly has proven that wrong. He's also shown to have a lot greater staying power than anybody anticipated. When you have billions, that will happen. And so his staying power and his being at the top of the polls has certainly been different for many, many Republicans. And do you need to take a break for a second? Let me just say this, too, about Carly Fiorina. In the first debate, when she was in the smaller debate, she performed extraordinarily well. Then on the big stage, she performed extraordinarily well. I would not minimize her performances. I would not minimize how she is doing. And I do think many people talk about John Kasich as a potential VP because of Ohio. Some do talk about her as a VP, in part because it balances the ticket. But we're a long way from VP selections. This is a very competitive race for the Republican nomination. Donald Trump is a multi-billionaire.
Yeah,
he's appealing to a large part of the electorate in terms of their frustration with Washington. He can't be underestimated.
What about his comment, though, that some Republicans might think she'll be tapped if Hillary Clinton's the Democratic nominee? Republicans might think, well, we need to put a woman on the ticket if the Democrats have a female nominee.
Like I said, I think that's a long way from now, the VP discussion. And I do think most pundits would agree that Hillary Clinton is very formidable and very likely to be the Democratic nominee. Having said that, there will be a lot of discussion about who a strong VP will be. Some would like one from Florida. It could be from Ohio. It could sometimes gender factors. A lot of different factors go into that selection. But I wouldn't underestimate her given her performances in the debate so far.
Lori in Jacksonville. Go ahead, Lori.
Hi there. I was hoping that Rick Mullaney and you would expound in detail on how the delegates are chosen so that those of us or those that are NPA affiliates would know how to get involved in that. So if it could be detailed, I understand why it is, but what the process is, I'm not very familiar with.
Yeah, thanks, Lori. Great question.
Well, I'm certainly not an expert on the delegation, on how they do their delegates. I will tell you that this is the result of the rules of that each party formulates. On the Republican side, I believe you have about 2,200 to maybe 2,300 total delegates. That's why Florida's 99 is such a big number, especially when it's winner take all. The Democratic Party formulates the rules on the Democratic side. And those rules also dictate whether or not your delegates will be awarded on a proportional basis, which means if you have 25% of the vote, you get 25% of the delegates, or a winner-take-all, which means if Donald Trump wins by 1% in Florida, he gets all 99 in Florida. So I think part of, for both the Republican and Democratic side, is to take a look at the total number of delegates, then take a look at the Republican and Democratic Party rules on how they're awarded, and then take a look at the time frame. One of the things that the Republican Party did in the wake of Governor Romney's loss 4 years ago was to revise the rules significantly to shorten the time period. You may notice that this primary season is really maybe 4 months. Last time it was nearly six. This is starting in February. Last time it started in January. The idea was to compress the time frame and to chain and to increase the penalties for states who tried to leap ahead. And so the Republican Party is in control of those rules on the Republican side. The Democratic Party is control on the Democratic side. And some of it is a numbers game in terms of looking at the award of the delegates.
Lots of tweets. Let's read a couple. Here's one from Jay. The Republican slate is a minefield of mediocre and or baggage-laden candidates. I don't believe the GOP nominee is in the race yet. Jason tweets the show, questioning whether Florida is actually a swing state. Over the past six elections in Florida, 41 million votes have been cast, with the Dems actually holding a mere 130,664 vote advantage. So what about that statistic, Rick Mullaney?
On the second numbers, you can take when these talk about swing state, you can see that Florida is in play. And the numbers reflect that it's in play, both in the general election last time and historically what has happened. And so therefore, you're going to see a focus on that. To the first tweet, let me just say this about the field. It's a very, there are some very accomplished, very, on both the Republican and Democratic side, very accomplished people running for president. It's very easy sometimes to be the armchair quarterback and to talk about the mistake they may have made or how they could have come across. But on the Republican and Democratic side, I would suggest there's some very talented, very experienced, very credentialed people running for president.
Let's go now to Dave in Nassau County. Hi, Dave. Thanks for holding. You're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. My comment is more in relation to the turmoil that's going on in the House. And I think one of the main reasons why that Congress has such a persistently low approval rating is due in large part because of the fact that it is not actually representative of the majority of American opinion because of the way that the Republican Party has manufactured their lead by gerrymandering many of the state districts. They end up having a hold of the House where in order for a Democrat House member to get elected, they end up having to have 1.5 times as many voters supporting them because of gerrymandering than they would otherwise. So if the House isn't reflective of the majority opinion of the United States, then they're naturally not going to be able to accomplish what needs to be done in the United States. And I'll take my response off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. I'll give you two big issues in which the caller, I think, maybe at odds with the caller's notion that the House isn't a reflection of the majority of the United States. One is Obamacare. If you take a look at the polls, you will take a look that nationally, Obamacare really is in disfavor. But what you had at the time was a majority on the Democratic side who were able to get it through. The second is the deal with Iran, which is also in disfavor nationally. The caller does make a good point, however, regarding the structuring of the off-term elections. You have sweeping majorities for the Republicans in state legislatures as well as in the House, and now you have a majority in the Senate. I think that's in jeopardy, by the way, next year for lots of reasons. But he does make a very good call with regard to what happens in off-year versus presidential elections. A lot of that relates to turnout. But the notion that they don't reflect the majority view of most Americans, that may or may not be the case depending on the issue. If you take a look at some of the issues on immigration, on what's called Obamacare, on the deal with Iran, I think you will see that, at least from a polling perspective, that the House does reflect many of the views of the majority in the country.
Jeff in St. Augustine. Go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, good morning. I had a couple points. One was just to pick up quickly on that. You know, my concern is that Republicans are going to spend a ton of money towards the end of the general election just to try to keep down turnout. I mean, that's how they've won all these midterm elections is by, you know, like 33% turnout. And, you know, they keep coming out with these tax plans that have, you know, lower income under $50,000 people paying no taxes. But then they go around and talk about makers and takers. So they keep coming out with tax plans that make more and more millions of people, quote unquote, takers. And then they campaign on it and make you feel bad for being a taker. And then the other thing is Carly Fiorina, you know, is very impressive. The problem is almost nothing she says is true. You know, so I'm not so sure how well that would work in a general election. And, you know, I've never been a Hillary Clinton supporter, but I mean, she kind of makes Hillary Clinton look like a nice person, which I think is a problem, too.
Thank you so much. That's Jeff in St. Augustine.
Jeff had several points. Let me just mention a little bit on the general election. I think one of the greater challenges for the Republican Party in the general election will be two things. One is trying to move a little bit to the center because one of the things that's happened in the primaries, you can see that the entire party is being pulled in a direction that may not help them in the general election. That's been true on many, many issues, including immigration, for example. The other is to make sure that they, as opposed to keeping voter turnout down, that they actually motivate their voters to show up. Because in 2012, what you saw was a lack of enthusiasm for their nominee and Mitt Romney, and a lot of Republicans stayed home. So in the general election, I think that is really going to be more of an issue. With respect to Carly Fiorina and Hillary Clinton, both of them have some challenging issues ahead in terms of it's a long way to the nomination. Hillary is is certainly preoccupied still with the challenges of the email scandal. We'll see where that turns out. Carly Fiorina, I think, has performed very admirably in the debates. She's just introducing herself to the American people, and we'll see what due diligence and closer scrutiny reveals for her.
Do you plan to do any more polling, maybe on the Democratic side, or just another poll looking at both parties, more polling in the future for your institute?
We do. Our board suggested polling as a part of the mission of the institute to be fully involved in public policy issues that shape the future of the city, the state, and the nation. Let's face it, the president is the most significant public policymaker in the world. This is an important election. We hope to play a constructive role in that. The reason that we limited it to the Republican side was because they had the first two debates, because it's very competitive. And the way we approached it is we wanted to fund it to be a very reliable poll, and we narrowed and used our resources in such a way as to have 585 likely registered Republican voters with personal interviews from everyone. And so looking to the future, we hope to be doing more and adding to the discussion and adding to the conversation.
Now, we're getting a couple of calls from people who felt that Lori's question wasn't answered about how you can become a delegate, whether it's to the Republican or Democratic parties here in Florida. What I think is the best course of action is to just contact the local party, whether it's the Republican Party of Duval or the Democratic Party, and start the process that way. So hopefully that answers that question. In the meantime, Rick Mullaney, director of JU's Public Policy Institute and host of our quarterly show Policy Matters, great conversation, and thanks so much for being with us.
I've enjoyed being with you. Thank you.
And much more still to come later. Sports with Cole, and even though summer's ending, the threat of melanoma is actually year-round. We've got skin cancer prevention tips from a local expert. But up next, First Coast Success profiles sports advocate Nancy Hogshead McCarr. We're back in a moment.
Radio is the great American songbook, oldies and light jazz.
The thing that's cool for me is that it feels like it's the music of my life.
Relax Radio is the station you can listen to all day on your HD radio. Make a $120 gift to WJCT and you'll receive an HD radio so you can tune in to Relax. Call 904-353-9528 for more information.
WJCTnews.org is your source for the latest local, national, and international news 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Podcasts of your favorite local stories and shows, the WJCT First Read every weekday morning, and playlists from all of our after-hours music programming. From your computer or mobile device, see it all at WJCTnews.org.
The PBS Fall Arts Festival, airing Friday nights on WJCT, is celebrating its fifth season of bringing audiences the best in arts programming. This season includes Unity, the Latin tribute to Michael Jackson, and Danny Elfman's music from the films of Tim Burton. WJCT will host live performances from Atlantic Beach Experimental Theater and Players by the Sea on the main stage of Hemming Park during the third annual Oktoberfest Downtown Art Walk on Wednesday, October 7, beginning at 5 p.m.
As a nurse, Teresa Brown says she's always worried she'll do too much or too little. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Brown about her new memoir, The Shift, about her life as an oncology nurse. Brown's first book, Critical Care, chronicling her first year as a nurse, is now used as a textbook at many nursing schools. Before becoming a nurse, Brown was a professor of English. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. Well, next month, our First Coast Connect book club will discuss writer David McCullough's latest biography, exploring the life of the Wright brothers. And we want you to be part of this. You can check out free copies of the book at the Jacksonville Public Library. They're our book club partner. We have other partners, Chamberlain's and The Book Mine. You can buy a copy there. Now, we want you to send us your thoughts about the Wright brothers. And let us know your memories of your first flight. Was it awful? Was it great? Send your thoughts to bookclub@wjct.org, and we'll read them aloud during our next book club discussion. Well, she's one of the leading national experts on Title IX. Nancy Hogshead Makar is a renowned athlete and scholar based here in North Florida. Karen Bruni Mathis of the Financial News and Daily Record spoke with her in today's First Coast Success.
Nancy Hogshead Makar is a civil rights lawyer, athlete, and advocate for women in sports. As an Olympic swimmer, she won 3 gold medals and 1 silver medal in the 1984 Summer Olympics. She is now the CEO of Champion Women, a nonprofit providing legal advocacy for girls and women in sports. Champion Women focuses on athletic gender equity issues, including equal sports participation and treatment, scholarship dollars, sexual harassment and abuse, employment, and pregnancy discrimination. In 2007, Sports Illustrated named her as one of the most influential people in the history of Title IX, a federal law enacted 43 years ago that prohibits sex discrimination in education. Nancy Hogshead Makar, thanks for joining First Coast Success.
Thank you for having me, Karen. Appreciate it.
Well, what motivated you to focus on promoting equality for women in sports?
Well, I think just as an attorney, I really enjoy being the advocate. And when you look at what's the area that I can make the most difference, it's athletics. I think I could have chosen lots of different things, but given my own background in sports, that it was a natural entree into being able to identify with athletes who were bringing these actions and who are having a lot of conflict. And so it's sort of my zen.
Well, how successful are your efforts?
Sometimes very successful, sometimes not so much. You might remember in 2009, I sued the Florida High School Athletic Association along with a law firm here in town. And we were very successful in a budget-cutting move. This was right during the financial crisis. They cut between 20 and 40% of all competitive opportunities except for football. So it means 30% of boys didn't have cuts and 100% of girls had cuts. So this was kind of a no-brainer. It's not something that we frankly should have ever had to involve a court in. But we were very successful in getting all the games restored for both boys and girls across the board.
Tell me about the Olympics. Describe the feel of winning 3 gold medals.
It's an extraordinary feeling. But I tell you, the race and the award ceremony is a whopping half an hour out of your life. The part that is truly extraordinary, the part that stays with me, is what it feels like to be excellent, what it feels like to have put in your 10,000 hours into something, to feel a type of beauty that you can't get from mascara, to feel a kind of grace with God, to feel that connection, you know, that sense of being strong and powerful and that I was in control of the water.
Well, what motivated you then to go to law school?
So before I went to law school, I was doing 3 things. I was endorsing a lot of products, and I was doing a lot of motivational speaking, and I was the president of the Women's Sports Foundation. So I was with the Women's Sports Foundation for 30 years, and I could tell that the people that were having the most fun in the gender equity issues were the lawyers. You know, today, if you look at me, you'd say, you know, you look like a female. But when I was growing up, I really wasn't. To grow up being non-gender conforming, I was very strong and really muscular, and I used to walk into the bathrooms and people would say, "Hey, that sign says women." And I'd be like, "I'm a girl." I sort of understood that I was told constantly, like, what you're doing is against social norms. Even though people, you know, I got a lot of praise and, you know, validation and whatnot, there was always this undercurrent of, like, wow, you're really not going to fit in the rest of your life. You're really going to have a hard time getting married. But I also understood how empowering a sports experience was and how important it was. And I wanted to make sure that other women had that opportunity. Right at the time that I was swimming in the Olympics, there was a bad United States Supreme Court decision called Grove City versus Bell. And in Grove City, the court held that the law, Title IX just says you have to give equal educational opportunities to boys and girls. Sports is one of those educational opportunities. So the law only applied to the part of the school that got the federal funds. So that if the library got money, the library couldn't discriminate. But if the housing program, the math program, the physics program, if the English department didn't get federal funds directly, then it could do whatever it wanted to do. So it kind of undercut the meaning of the law. Most athletic departments don't get any tax dollars. They don't get federal funds. So we had to go back to Congress to essentially get Title IX passed twice. We were successful. So that was like my jumping point, if you will, of recognizing how important sports was for me. If it hadn't been for this law, I mean, I came out of high school. I was world champion. I was, you know, had dual meets against the East Germans and the Russians, American record holder, world record holder, you know, about as accomplished as you can get. And I can tell you that if it hadn't been for that law, I would not have gotten a college scholarship. Women who were just 2 years older than I was that had my same credentials that were, you know, equally as acclaimed did not have a college scholarship opportunity. So I hit it just right. I mean, as far as being able to get a lot out of that statute. So here it is, you know, 31 years later. And, you know, I want to make sure that as many girls as possible have that experience.
Now, you're also a community leader. You spend a lot of time in the community. What advice do you have for the city as the city moves forward?
I don't know. It's such a great city. I mean, I think there's so much to offer. I mean, my big push right now is having an equal rights ordinance here in Jacksonville so that LGBT community can get the same protections that women have and that African Americans have, and that they can't be fired for their sexual orientation. I just think that's really important for the business aspect, and lots of business leaders have come out and said the same thing. In sports, I rarely run into a case, whether it's a girls' participation case or a coaching employment case, that doesn't have some form of anti-lesbianism in the case. So whether it's we don't want to do softball because lesbians do softball, to a coach who is told that they can't recruit lesbians. If they are a lesbian, then they have a particularly hard time getting a job. So I think if Jacksonville had the ordinance, I think that would be a great thing.
Well, Nancy Hogshead-Makar, Olympic gold medalist and sports equality advocate, thank you for joining First Coast Success.
Thank you, Karen, for having me on. I really appreciate it.
And read the partial transcript of Karen's talk with Nancy Hogshead-Makar in today's Daily Record. We're back in a moment.
This is Watch Officer Miller Norton with the Duval County Emergency Preparedness Division. Disasters can strike with little to no notice. Create your disaster kit now, including water, non-perishable food, batteries, flashlight, weather radio, and important documents. Visit jacksready.com for more information and tune to 89.9, the designated emergency broadcaster for Northeast Florida.
Today's First Coast Success was brought to you in part by Iberia Bank.
Fred Savage, child actor, director, producer, and now back in front of the camera.
I like that all. I know that's such a bogus answer, but I really do. I mean, I have been working in the TV business since I was 6 years old.
I'm Adrienne Hill, the kid from the Wonder Years all grown up. Next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT Community Supported Public Radio.
If you love All Things Considered, consider joining us a few hours early for Afternoons on WJCT. The Takeaway offers a fresh way to look at the news, featuring critical conversations, reports from the field, and listener participation. That's followed by The World, with engaging voices to illuminate what's going on around the globe and why it matters to you. It's the smart way to spend your afternoons. Weekdays from 2 to 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
Follow what's happening at WJCT, even when you're away from your radio. You can follow WJCT on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can listen live online to WJCT FM at wjct.org/listen or on iTunes Radio or TuneIn Radio. And you can hear all of your favorite WJCT FM shows anytime on demand on iTunes and Stitcher. Wherever you are, WJCT is there.
Welcome back. Well, in recent months, there's been an outpouring of support for former President Jimmy Carter. The 91-year-old Carter is still teaching Sunday school up in Plains, Georgia. This despite his recent diagnosis of malignant melanoma, a form of skin cancer that has since spread to his brain. Every year, one in five Americans is diagnosed with skin cancer. Dr. William Sumner, surgical oncologist at St. Vincent's Riverside, joins us now in studio with some very important information on skin cancer prevention. Doctor, good morning.
Good morning.
And it's so sad to see Carter's diagnosis. Melanoma starts on the skin, but then it can spread to other organs. He has a particularly advanced case.
Yes, his disease is stage four if he's got brain metastases.
Right. But it's a reminder to all of us that skin cancer is nothing to mess around with, and it's actually relatively common. One in five Americans will be diagnosed.
It is. It's one of the most common types of skin cancer. Melanoma, a little less so, but rolled in with squamous cell and basal cell, it's the most common type of cancer.
Sure. Now, St. Vincent's Riverside over the weekend had a free screening for people to come and have their skin checked to see if there were any irregular growths or moles,
yes.
An important free event.
Yes. We try to do that at least once a year.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about melanoma. Signs and symptoms and what people need to know.
Well, melanoma is usually the most serious of the different skin cancers. It usually presents as some type of pigmented, you know, dark lesion on the skin. Sometimes that can be something that's changing in an area where a patient has had a mole in the past. Most commonly, it's picked up because they notice something that's either new or something that has been there and is now changing in some way, becoming raised, changing color, enlarging in size.
Mm-hmm. And you recommend that everybody once a year should go to a dermatologist and have their entire body checked, particularly people living here in Florida.
Particularly here, we're in the Sun Belt. This is an area of the country really that stretches from Los Angeles down across the southern United States and kind of extends up a little bit along the East Coast where sun exposure is higher. People are often out in the sun over the course of their lives. It's important to wear sunscreen to try to protect yourself from that risk.
So. What else should people do to protect themselves? Obviously, wear sunscreen.
Yeah. Covered clothing when you're out. That also will help protect against ultraviolet radiation that causes genetic mutations and predisposes to melanoma and to other skin cancers.
Isn't there an anagram, too, when it comes to melanoma, A, B, C, D, E?
Sure, and that's a way to determine what factors about the primary melanoma that should be looked at, or a primary skin lesion, really, I should say, to determine whether it's one that you really want to worry about. So A is area, the size of the lesion, usually if it's larger than the size of a pencil eraser. B is the borders. If they're nice and smooth, that's less worrisome. If it's more irregular, then that's more concerning. Color for C, that's if you see variegated color where it's different colors within the same lesion, or again, if the color is changing, it's been brown, is changing into red or blue, or then that's more concerning. D, diameter. Same thing, the size of the lesion.
If it grows in size.
E is evolution. So is it changing over time?
So if you have a mole or a lesion on your body and you have those A, B, C, D, E characteristics, it's time to get to the doctor.
Absolutely. And another important thing to know is that patients who have family members with melanomas are more likely to have melanomas themselves. So if you have any family history, that's another predisposition. And should you notice something that's new or changing or different, then that really should be looked at quickly because even small, relatively innocuous-looking things, particularly in terms of melanoma, can be big problems.
Summer's ending, but we shouldn't let our guard down in the cooler months either, right?
No. And, you know, these do – there is a – an annual variation in the presentation, but that's probably a factor of people being wearing lighter clothing and being less likely to notice things during the summer months than in the winter. But it can occur anytime during the year.
Yeah, so very important tips, and we thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Dr. William Sumner is a surgical oncologist at St. Vincent's in Riverside. And from the Jags to the Gators, a busy football weekend. Culpepper's up next.
Join WJCT for a dinner honoring this year's American Graduate Champions, Wednesday, September 30th, 6 p.m. at the WJCT studios. Hear their stories and learn how their efforts are making a difference in increasing graduation rates here on the First Coast. For more information and tickets, 358-6327, WJCT.org.
I'm Catherine Burns, one of the hosts of the Moth Radio Hour, and I hope you'll join us here on 89.9 WJCT. With true personal stories told live without notes to standing room crowds around the world, Moth stories aren't part of the disposable daily information flow. They stick with you, and you'll even find yourself retelling them. Listen Saturdays at 3 p.m. here on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, finally, this hour from the Jaguars to the Gators. Lots of sports news this week.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper. Wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
A huge weekend of football, Cole. Where to begin?
Let's start first with the Jaguars. A 51-17 loss to the New England Patriots yesterday in Foxborough. For starters, now this was not a game the Jaguars were supposed to win, even though some optimistic Jaguars fans were calling for the upset to shock the world after last week's win over Miami. It just wasn't going to happen. The Patriots are one of the best teams in the league, and best teams don't lose at home to teams who are trying to establish themselves as a legitimate NFL-quality squad like the Jaguars. So if you can put aside the way the game was lost and look simply that the game was lost, this one won't sting quite as much. And if the Jaguars can win next week, things will look a whole lot rosier. But if you can't get past the way the game was lost, and you wouldn't be alone, by the way, you have to ask the question, who are the real Jaguars? Are they the team that couldn't move the ball and failed to stop the Panthers in the fourth quarter on opening day? Or are they the team that, for the majority of last week's game, outplayed the Dolphins? Or are they the team that looked outclassed and at times flustered against the defending Super Bowl champs yesterday? Here's my theory. They are all of those things. Because they're a young team, they're going to be erratic this year. Don't expect them to deliver the same kind of performance in consecutive weeks. It's just the way it is. The ironic thing is that with the now famous three-year plan, this is really how the Jaguars were supposed to be last year, and unless they suddenly mature this year, the results at the end of the year are going to tell us a lot about the future of the franchise, at least on the field. Speaking of the next game, the Jaguars go on the road to face the Indianapolis Colts Sunday. The Colts, like the Jaguars, are 1-2 this year. By the way, so are the Titans and the Texans, so everybody is at once in first place and in last place in the AFC South.
And how about the college football weekend? That was a wild one in Gainesville.
Yeah, the Gators had beaten Tennessee the past 10 meetings, and it looked like the Vols would finally get one, but leading by 6 with a minute and a half remaining, they saw Florida freshman Antonio Callaway take a short pass and run 63 yards for the go-ahead touchdown. In the final seconds, Tennessee attempted a 55-yard field goal to win it, but it was wide right. The Gators are now 4-0 under new head coach Jim McElwain. Big test Saturday for Florida. They host third-ranked Ole Miss. Georgia steamrolled to a 4-0 start of their own with a 48-6 thrashing of Southern. Bulldogs will get a test of their own Saturday on in Athens when they host 13th-ranked Alabama. Undefeated Florida State back to work this week as they travel to Wake Forest. The Seminoles and maybe Clemson look like the class of the ACC this year.
Yeah, and after a coaching change earlier in the week, the Armada put on a good show Saturday.
Yeah, that's right. After 5 games without a goal and the team failing to get out of the cellar in the standings, the Armada said goodbye to head coach Guillermo Hoyos and his staff and elevated a guy with a lot of local ties, Eric Dade, to the interim head coaching position. The Armada on Saturday wore red jerseys, a tribute to the old Jacksonville T-Men, and they proceeded to beat cross-state rivals the Tampa Bay Rowdies 2-0 in front of a crowd of over 7,000 at Community First Park. They're no longer in the cellar, now level on points with two other teams in eighth, and still mathematically have a chance to make the postseason with six matches to play, including Saturday against the new last-place team, Indy 11.
Now, you mentioned the new interim head coach has some local ties.
Yeah, Eric Dade has been the executive director of JFC, Jacksonville Football Club, the Armada Developmental Academy, and in 2011 he coached JUFC, a fourth division soccer team in Jacksonville, to a national championship with three guys who are now on the Armada roster. He was also a professional player for 16 years, including in the MLS, so certainly has a very good pedigree, and he got things off to the right start in his coaching tenure with the Armada on Saturday.
All right, follow Cole on Twitter, at Cole Pepper. Thanks as always, Cole.
Thanks, Melissa.
And that's our program. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme, composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. Questions or comments about the program, just send an email to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And make sure to subscribe to our daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Next on Diane Rehm, House Speaker John Boehner announces he'll resign from Congress at the end of October. A look at what that move could mean for a potential government shutdown, the Republican Party, and prospects for cooperation in Congress. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.